Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Return of the Truth and Movies. In today's show, Mad Manx action in Mindhorn as faded former TV star struggles to adjust to role on the periphery of life. Wonder what that's like. Also, Tampopo, venerated Japanese noodle western, is finally out on Blu-ray. But is it just Karate Kid with ramen? Film Club 2046, did you do your homework? We salute Jonathan Demme and start getting excited about aliens. All of that in this Truth and Movies. It's a Little White Lies podcast. Good. Welcome, everybody, then. Say hello to my little friends. That's a quote from a film, actually.
No, I've not seen that one.
David Jenkins and Adam Woodward of Little White Lies. This is David Jenkins.
Hi.
And that's Adam Woodward.
Hello.
Right, excellent. And you can get in touch with us, by the way, either on Twitter, at LWLies, or... And this is recommended email, truthandmovies, or one word, at tco.london, or one word, .com. Did people get in touch this week, David?
Yeah, we got a few pigeon posts and whatnot. I think we did get an email.
We got an email. We did. Do you want to know what it said?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, this is from Josh Senior, who takes exception to you suggesting that all Marvel movies are broadly the same.
Well, I mean, everyone can have their opinion, but you know, it's what I'm saying is, you know, it's a fact. I mean,
well, he suggests that he lists his favourites and that. It's just, for example, Ant-Man. It's quite different within the genre. It's very much a heist movie with superhero trimmings. He also mentions, as deserving of praise, Captain America, the Winter Soldier and Civil War, Doctor Strange and Guardians of the Galaxy, suggesting there's a fairly diverse kind of spectrum, if you like, there of film types. I would add in Deadpool, which I thought was pretty different to... Too safe? No,
I'd call Deadpool different.
Yeah, I would say that it's a bit like, you know how like M&Ms are all different colours, but like actually they're all the same. You know, but they look different.
They taste good,
it's a bit like that. I think.
Oh, right. Unlike Smarties.
Yeah, or I mean Smarties.
Because
you've
got the orange, the chocolate orange Smarties.
I mean, the orange one is the kind of the exception that proves the rule. The one that will eventually come on along that will be an experimental.
Were they called Revels or Revels?
These
many years
like
ago, where you genuinely would get different contents within the...
Because that is a surprise.
That is a surprise.
I think I would prefer cinema to be more like Revels than Smarties.
Right. Do you know what? Just on that note, one of the greatest cinematic surprises I ever had was when I went to see a movie and the person next to me, and this is going to get chopped out because it's going to go on for a while, this anecdote. The person next to me had a big box of salty popcorn, which he invited me to dip into. And I dipped my hand into it. We're in the dark of the cinema. And I felt, instead of little pieces of popcorn or along with them, a lump of something congealed. I'm thinking, what on earth is in this popcorn? I assumed it was maybe the butter that had just kind of run together and formed. But having had a drink or two, I just ate it anyway. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences because there in the middle of this salty popcorn, in the dark, unexpectedly, chocolate. The guy had taken a bag of Cadbury's clusters and shaken them out and then shaken the box out. So you had the salty popcorn and a chocolate mix. It was extraordinary.
I was a bit worried about where that was going initially.
Yeah. But have you seen
Diner?
Yeah, Diner.
Diner, yeah.
Mickey Rourke in Diner.
Yeah.
It's not chocolate in there.
Certainly isn't.
I'm slightly worried that a random stranger offered you his popcorn.
It wasn't a random stranger.
Oh, OK, fine.
It was a carefully selected stranger. Anyway, here's Alex Hess getting in touch because I was talking about Fast and Furious last week. He says it might be of interest, your appraisal of the Fast and Furious movies. He's got a link to a Boston Globe article from 2011, to be fair, but the article makes a very interesting point that one of the reasons for its success is the fact that it is a racially integrated or a film with a kind of broad spectrum of heritages that in no way plays on that for the drama of the film. Generally speaking, if you look at the highest grossing films, they tend to be all white cast, or if they're not, they're making a point about some kind of tension or comedy inherent in the blend of heritages. So it was a fascinating, and there's a couple of other thoughts from listeners which we'll get onto later on. Because right now, let's unleash the mind horn. Sean Foley's film Mindhorn, which opens on Friday the 5th of May, certainly in the UK, is starring Julian Barrett as failing actor Richard Thorncroft, whose career peak came in the late 80s, playing TV cop Mindhorn, who's got a bionic eye which enables him to see the truth, who now returns to the Isle of Man where the series was shot to negotiate with a criminal who believes the character was real. Well, it's an interesting film in the tradition of British cinema comedy. And in fact, Adam, you yesterday had the great pleasure of hearing Simon Farnaby, who plays the shirtless Dutch stuntman in the film, talking to Julian Barrett about their comedy heroes.
My dad took me to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail when I was young, and many times. And so I was obsessed with that film. And also I listened to a lot of radio comedy, Hancock. And you didn't know this, did you, Simon?
No, I didn't know. This is all new information.
All new to Simon.
Did you not have a TV in your house?
No, because this was the 30s.
It's
the 1930s.
I think I would have guessed that about you. Someone said, did you have a TV in his house? And I'd have gone, he just listened to a radio.
Yeah. So there was Hancock's Half Hour, Stepped On Star on the radio shows of those I would listen to, Bob Newhart, some American stuff, Woody Allen as well, the sort of early funny films, you know, Love and Death and Sleeper, which me and my sister would
do. The overtly funny ones.
Yeah, we would act out, you know, scenes from, not Husbands and Wives or anything like that, but from the earlier ones.
Husbands and Wives is still pretty good.
Yeah, but when we were 7 or 8, it wasn't.
Oh, you're not going to be into all that sexual politics.
No. So that, and just the usual, I mean, the usual sort of people, I suppose. There was no one, I don't think there was anyone particularly unusual on that.
What about American? Were you like American?
American.
When did that start? I don't know. Thinking of, I suppose Woody Allen is.
Well, the American sort of show. You mean later on when I got into doing comedy? I mean, it's a different sort of thing, I suppose.
I suppose I mean for films, you know, like the Will Ferrell, Ben Stiller, and all those lot.
Oh, yeah, but I was doing that was when I was doing comedy.
Oh,
I mean,
that's
they
when
are
you were doing
heroes,
it.
Of course, but.
Not heroes, like Childhood Heroes.
I just wanted to put that out there.
Right, and you can see all of that interview, Adam, where?
You can see it on littlewhitelies.com, and we'll probably pop it on YouTube and all the other usual social media sites as well.
All right. Mindhorn, then.
Yes.
Terrible trailer. Terrible. I mean, really awful trailer.
I don't know. I can't remember actually seeing the trailer.
Okay. It was bad.
It was, right, I'll
tell
you
what. I think it's
trying
to. It's a very unconventional film, and it's essentially taking bits from that and trying to put it in a conventional format, and it just doesn't. But enough about the trailer. What's the film like?
I really love this film. I can't think of a time I've laughed harder in the cinema. Certainly recently, in recent years. It has this amazing blend of mainstream comedy and sort of surrealism, very much in the kind of Mighty Boosh, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place mould. It's quite a sort of traditional comedy in a lot of ways. And I think the script is a bit ropey in places, although I kind of love it for that, in spite of that. I just think the character feels so well realised, basically. In fact, when I was down yesterday seeing Simon Farnaby and Julian Barrett, there were all these props, kind of naff merchandise, lunchboxes and Mindhorn action figures.
The action figures, extraordinary. That the way that they've created the whole milieu of Mindhorn, and there's a grotto, almost a shrine to him in the film, which I think is brilliantly done.
Yeah, and it actually the character started off. It first appeared in a 2001 episode of a BBC Radio 4 series, which Mighty Boosh star Julian Barrett was a part of. So the character obviously is quite different, I think, to that initial incarnation, but it's something that feels like it's been developed since there, basically.
Right. And it does feel almost as if it was a series back in the 80s that is being revisited. I mean, it feels 100% real and at the same time deeply surreal. So Adam says surreal, he loved it, laughed incredibly hard, little bit ropey in places, but you almost feel that that was intentional, such as its homage to dodgy 80s cop dramas.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I remember seeing this at the London Film Festival in the kind of big Leicester Square Odeon, and it was a riot. I mean, it was such an amazing atmosphere, having, like, you know, 1,000+ people laughing together at the same time at these very silly jokes. I don't want to sound too negative, but one of the things I'm really down on is this kind of wave of sitcoms, TV sitcoms, that then evolve into movies. Mm. And I find that really, like, weird.
Where did you stand on Alpha Papa then?
I was tepid on Alpha Papa. I mean, I love the original I'm Alan Partridge. I guess to give another sort of slightly strange metaphor again, if that's permissible, it's a bit like seeing, like, one of your school teachers in a pub. Like, you know, like, they're not supposed to exist outside of school, you know, and it's like seeing them in a real place. It's like, oh, why are you here? Why are you doing this? And that's how I feel about seeing a sitcom in the cinema. It's like, no, you're not meant to be, you know, this is the wrong place that you know, I shouldn't be seeing you here.
Has there ever been a film version of a TV show that you've enjoyed?
No, never. Not that I can instantly recall. I quite liked, and this is probably going against the grain a little, I quite liked a film called Guesthouse Paradiso, which was a spin-off of the sitcom Bottom, with Rick Mayall and Aidan Edmondson. It's quite a arcane... weird film, and it's not talked of much, but I think a revival is due soon, but yeah, with this one, I think it has that. It maybe feels like it could have been a sitcom, but actually, it doesn't have those shackles. It doesn't have those kind of, oh, we've got to sort of play on what people know about the character already. Mm. We can just start from scratch, and there can be a lot of assumed knowledge and detail from other stuff as well. I mean, I think that maybe in a way, this does feel a lot like Partridge and the Bush, and you do get added value from having seen those and knowing some of the kind of references. But at the same time, it's structured as an actual movie.
Right. More than the actual mind-torn cop drama, I'd be interested to see the spin-off show, which in turn overshadows it eventually within the kind of the fictional world of this movie, in which Steve Coogan, I think it's called Windjammer, becomes this tremendously successful... doing what we never know, but Steve Coogan's in this film, and which I found a bit weird to begin with. So I went to see it, and you guys had said this is amazing, and I'd said the trailers are awful. Are you sure? You said yes. So I went, and within Julian Barrett opening his mouth the first time, most of the screening room were absolutely in tears over this. And I was thinking, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to be on board for this. And especially when it became clear that it's playing on much the same kind of comedic notes of this... a figure who's entirely without self-awareness, who's entirely delusional about his impact and role within the world, very much like an Alan Partridge or potentially a David Brent as well. And you know, there's kind of a subtopic here about what is it about our national character that makes us so interested in these figures who are obsessed with their past and former glories and can't cope with current realities. But that's a socio-political point for another day. But little by little, about half an hour in, I realised, oh my word, I'm actually really enjoying this. And compared to Partridge, what I thought was delightful about it is, apart from the fact that the character's got way more humanity than Partridge had. Partridge is basically exasperating and irritating, but there's something about Mindhorse that's actually really charming, despite himself.
I think so. I mean, he's a sort of slightly tragic, kind of unsympathetic character, but as you say, there's a humanity about him. I feel like you warm to him in a way that it feels quite natural. I mean, it doesn't feel ever forced, like they're desperate for you to kind of like this character.
Yeah,
that's what I kind of think about the one of the issues with the Partridge film and the David Brent film is that there was, on one half, there was like, oh, look at these tragic figures, and on the other half it was like, oh, but how lovable are they really, if you and they kind of push, they try and push and present that lovability element, like, oh, he's awful, but he's lovely. Mm. And I think that with Mindhorn, they don't do that. They say he's completely awful, but let's just look at what he does to find if there is any humanity
right.
in there.
And well, the other thing that's interesting about this is that whereas Coogan with Partridge is completely based in our world, and as such, I think is more annoying than anything. Whereas because Mindhorn exists in, as you say, Adam, a completely surreal world. I mean, it's like a weird, trippy kind of John Nettles fever dream, this whole kind of Mindhorn, Manx, Isle of Man environment. That has a charm, and then you kind of accept him for what he is in his own universe. I mean, we're basically visiting his world in this film, yeah. whereas someone like a Partridge or a Brent are very much people who are deluded but are in our world.
Yeah, no, this is, I think the film is a fantasy film. I mean, it's, you know, there is that sort of, it departs from realism, even from the sort of opening scenes of seeing the Mindhorn TV show. I mean, it's kind of so ridiculous that you kind of, it sets you up very early on as like, no, we're not, this isn't like, you know, kitchen sink realism here. This is, this is something else.
There's a really interesting sort of mundanity to it as well. I mean, I've never been to the Isle of Man, but it's not doing a lot for the Isle of Man Tourism Board. But at the same time, it kind of sets up this place which feels so, I guess, ingrained or woven into the fabric of British life and British comedy in particular. Right.
But yet is other.
Right. Yeah. So it's a really kind of familiar setting.
All right. I must admit, I left the cinema feeling almost like someone had played a very elaborate practical joke on me, which I had quite... I mean, I had very much enjoyed it. Actually, I did really enjoy the film. I thought Simon Farnaby as Dutch shirtless stuntman was brilliant, movie-stealingly good. And I love the cameos. There's a couple of brilliant cameos in this. And I'm just gently stunned that this was from Steve Coogan. It was a Baby Cow production, though. Mm. And Ridley Scott's exec produce.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. So, marks.
I think for anticipation, I mean, these kind of British comedies tend to come and go. And off the back of the David Brent movie and Alpha Papa, I was a little bit unsure where I was going to go with this. So a 3 for anticipation, but yeah, absolutely loved it. 4 for enjoyment, 4 for in retrospect. Mm.
I would, ditto for that exactly. I mean, I must say, like, that these films, before you see them, that there is a bit of an unknown quantity element to them. Like, you know, why is this a thing? You have to kind of ask yourself. And but you know, to say I was pleasantly surprised, it would be an understatement.
Right. I mean, I was pleasantly shocked because it was anticipation 1 and then a big 4. Pushing 5, loved it. And were I on a transatlantic flight to use that incredibly useful gauge, I would definitely watch it again.
Yeah, I would tell my fellow passengers to also tune in.
Right. I mean, would you? I don't know. With all of that praise, I still have the sense that not everyone's going to get this film, and certainly...
All right, maybe I wouldn't tell the fellow passengers to tune in, but what I might do is if I saw someone in the seat in front of me watching, I might look over and watch while they were watching as well, and probably still get some enjoyment.
And you know what? I might even tap them on the shoulder, because I'm good with strangers watching films, as we know. But just because it would feel like we were both part of a very special club.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. A favourite pastime of mine, actually, is to... on long-haul flights, watch someone else watching a film.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
I would recommend trying it next time.
That's very, like, Hitchcockian, I think.
What's the best experience you've ever had in that field?
I saw someone fairly recently watching the film, Todd Haynes' film Carol.
Right.
Which is a sort of very beautiful, elegant love story. And about halfway through the film, there's a love scene, sex scene. And I got the sense that this person wasn't really enjoying the film all that much, but... they sort of woke up a bit at that scene and then proceeded to sort of rewind and rewatch it several times. So,
All right. Hey, I tell you what, speaking of sex scenes halfway through, that brings us on nicely to our other big release this week, Tam Po Po. We're going to be talking about that after we hear, by way of goodbye to Mindhorn, from Julian Barrett as the eponymous hero, singing his 80s smash, You Can't Handcuff the Wind.
The moon was hot, the time was right, and you were looking so good. Our body heat was rising, I thought you understood. We had some fun together, but I never promised you forever.
It's not my style.
No, no, no. You can't handcuff the wind, and if you try, you're gonna fail.
It's like trying to put thunder in jail.
Trying to put thunder in jail.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now, Tampa Poe is out this week on Blu-ray. Was it not available for ages then?
I don't think so. Okay. Certainly not in the kind of deluxe Blu-ray, all bells and whistles edition that it is currently kind of being released as now.
Right.
I mean, it's a film that I'd always known about, and I always thought it was one of these films that people, like older people, would watch at like key parties. You know those like where you it was a key party film for me.
A key party being something, Adam, you won't know this, but you put your keys in the middle of the table.
Yeah, and you do parties.
You can go to other people's houses.
I thought it was a bit of a kind of sexy film.
Oh, really? Okay. And there is some of that stuff in there.
There is, but it's actually different to what I was expecting.
Yeah, awesome.
But yeah.
Okay, so this is Juzo Itami's, and excuse my pronunciations, 1985 film. Juzo Itami, who came to a very unseemly end, he fell off a building. And he'd had issues with the Yakuza before because he made a Yakuza satire and they slashed his face up in retaliation. And supposedly a Yakuza told police afterwards that they told him to jump off a building, put a gun in his face and said, we can shoot you or you can take your chances with the fall. And he did because, yeah, they weren't fans. But anyway, before any of that unpleasantness, which happened in 1997, in 1985, he made this legendary film about basically a noodle restaurant, a truck driver who stops at this small family-run noodle shop and decides to help its fledgling business and indeed the woman who runs it, who's called Tampa Poe, which means dandelion. And the story is intertwined with various vignettes about our relationship, with the relationship between love and food, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. In the cast, a young Ken Watanabe, who's from such films as The Last Samurai, Batman Begins, Inception, he was good in that, and Godzilla. This is an early appearance from him as a young truck driver called Gun. And a bit like ramen, I think this was a conscious metaphor. You've got your main broth of the story of them trying to sort the restaurant out and make it into the best little ramen shop in the East. And then you've got all these other little kind of ingredients and spices that are dropped in at seemingly random intervals. Do you know, this film has got 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's unsurprising, I would
say.
Is
that unsurprising?
Well, I mean, all that means is that 100% of people have rated it above 3 out of 5.
Mm. So is that all?
So, I mean, you know, it's not that big a deal.
Oh, okay. Who's going to talk about this? David?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, as I say, this is a film that I'd often read about and heard about through other people's conversations and never actually seen before this release came out.
At key parties, yeah.
When I was at the key parties, yeah. I think it's a really fascinating film. It's a comedy. I wouldn't say it was like a comedy in the same way as like Mindhorn is a comedy. It's a comedy you don't really laugh at, but you have a sort of burst of inner warmth occasionally.
It's gentle.
Yes, it's a gentle comedy. It's got some there's a very funny little kind of preamble at the beginning with a Yakuza in a cinema with all his kind of food set out, and he kind of tells a guy that if he's eating very loud he's going to kill him, which I very much espouse in the kind of cinema going process. But yeah, I mean, it's this really nice film about, I guess it's very pro being the best you can be, and which sounds quite bland, I guess, but I mean,
climbing your ladder.
I guess it's this idea of he's kind of trying to get her to deconstruct what it is she does, and by extension, her life and her lifestyle and the way she thinks about the world and people, and then kind of enhance all these little individual elements and bring them all together at the end, which is quite, you know, it's quite philosophical in that way.
Should people get the Blu-ray or view it via some medium or other?
I think yes. Well, this Blu-ray edition's really nice, beautiful, restored. You know, it's a really nice way to see it, I think. You know, I think there's probably going to be cinema opportunities to see it as well, and it's probably worth catching. But yeah, no, it's nice. It's just a very. I mean, in a kind of lame sort of way, the first thing I thought of when I finished seeing it is that I want to go and have a ramen right now.
Right.
So, yeah, I did that. And it wasn't a very good ramen, which was slightly disappointing. So I almost sort of entered into a weird version of the film myself, but then I stopped there.
Okay.
I would say it's not a film to watch while you're eating, though, because there's a few moments that sort of throw you a little bit. I mean, there's a few quite surprising moments, let's say.
Mm.
One involving a sort of sploshing scene. There's a few sort of
is
sex
that the kind
peppered.
Of hardcore prawn scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hardcore
right.
prawn.
Well, yeah, when the Yakuza is in the hotel room, and there's a spoiler alert, with his bae.
So he pops that... Sorry, carry on.
Well, he spreads salt on bits of her and licks that off and squeezes lemons, and then brings out a couple of live prawns that he happens to have in his pocket and puts them on her belly, and they kind of wriggle around and stuff.
Are they prawns? I thought they were like... lobsters, maybe.
Yeah, but that doesn't work with hardcore.
I think they're like tiger prawns.
Anyway, but in general, Adam, how did you feel?
I think this movie is very original. I mean, I don't think I've seen a film like it before. Again, it sort of surprises you. I love the whole movie within a movie that you have this Yakuza character who opens the film, and you know, you have this amazing narrative all the way through that. You're never really sure where you are with it or where it's going, but
right.
Yeah, it's a strange film, but I think it's something which it doesn't feel dated in any way. I mean, I can't imagine what it would have been like watching this film in the 1980s when you know, there wasn't really a lot of like, you know, probably wouldn't have been a trailer for it. It may well have been a film that had been at a festival and certainly wouldn't have had a lot of kind of hype behind it. I wasn't really sure what to expect, and I think it exceeded any kind of ideas I had about what it would be.
Really? Okay. On a completely unrelated note, you were saying before about TV shows becoming movies, and I was trying to think, there was an example of one that continually references the difficulty of transitioning from one to the other, but I thought worked brilliantly, and it's finally come to me. The Simpsons movie. The Simpsons movie, glorious bit of cinema.
Compared to the early vintage days of The Simpsons, it's
really
I remember feeling it was a bit of a
really.
It was good, but
I'll
tell
you what, I'll give you the South Park movie.
Oh, the South Park movie.
The South Park movie is probably
exception. Perhaps you, listener, have an alternative suggestion, but do let us know for next week. All right, so you guys both love Tampopo and can understand why it's become this kind of legendary, amazing, must-see food movie.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase kind of cult film gets banded around quite a lot, and I never really know what that means, because to me that just means it's sort of popular. But this genuinely feels, I mean, if there's ever a film that you could apply that to, it feels like this one. And it's also a film about the craft and the art of movie making as well, as much as it is about food. So it kind of works on that level. It's quite sort of meta.
There's a scene in it which I was very fond of, where it's a kind of homage to Charlie Chaplin, where you have this kind of street tramp, and he kind of takes this young girl and breaks into a restaurant, and you see him cooking an omelette, and it's all just done in what feels like real time, but he just makes this very beautiful, simple dish, just like that. It's just a really nice scene to watch. I thought, like, just watching how simple quick and easy it is, you can make something so beautiful.
Yeah, that was his Chaplin-esque vinette. You've also got kind of vaguely kind of kung fu movie vignettes. There's the western theme that kind of recurs throughout, and there's various different, a bit of Yakuza action in there as well. Here's the thing: I really didn't like this film. I thought I was going to, because you know, you've heard things, and when it started, I thought this is quite charming. I like the fourth wall breaking exercise at the start, where the Yakuza addresses us, and this whole kind of business of her evolving her noodle shop and trying to make it better, and the kind of Seven Samurai way that they try, that these different characters come in to try and improve a different aspect of it. I was really enjoying that, but then these cursed vignettes kept coming in, and I just didn't feel any of them. So for me, this whole film was a little bit like, I mentioned Karate Kid back at the start, and there's a definite tie in there, but it was almost like My Fair Lady with noodles, but directed by the artistic director of the Hello Kitty range.
Wow.
I mean, it was, for me, I thought, desperately dated. It reeked of the 80s in the way it was shot, the whole kind of pacing, and what it thought was kind of good enough to pass muster as comedy. And that Chaplin bit was one of the bits I thought, oh my goodness, where is this film going? It's nice enough. It's a cute enough film, in my opinion. But I was staggered that it's lived with this reputation, which is why I kind of emailed you, Adam, and said, when did you last see this movie? Assuming you were going to say, well, yeah, not for 20 years or so. I just didn't happen for me at all.
I still can't get over the Hello Kitty diss.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cold.
No, for example, this film, right? I was just thinking, okay, so why was everyone so down on Chef? Jon Favreau's admittedly fairly mainstream and largely flawed paying to a chef who goes on the road with a food truck to make cubanos and one or two other little things along the way, in essentially a kind of a metaphor for his own decision to reject the Hollywood industry and take things out on the road a little bit more indie fashion, which I terrifically enjoyed in the context of its own ambition. Mm-hmm. Why does that kind of largely seen as, oh, nothing in particular, but this is venerated?
Well, I think this is trying to do something with form rather than just tell a very kind of conventional... I mean, you know, Chef's quite a conventional story.
That's
and this
true.
Is actually, I think this feels quite radical.
No,
I
okay.
mean, you know,
in terms of its... Yeah, I mean, you're right, in its portmanteau structure.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it's trying to do something with the shape of the movie rather than just... You know, have the sort of foodie Karate Kid element at the beginning. I mean, I guess one of the things that I felt a little bit, I thought it was a bit strange that it was, that the central concept of it was this one woman having to impress all these men. It was,
right.
it felt quite strange that the men were the experts and the woman was the kind of the one who had to do stuff to make it to impress them, which felt a little bit dated, I think. You know, maybe that's my kind of PC mind imposing values onto the past that weren't there in the 80s. Because they didn't have feminism in the 80s. Is that true?
No, no, very much so.
Oh,
yeah.
Good, yeah, right.
I think certainly the story feels slightly dated, but what you're talking about, the form, I think the way it's constructed, that for me is what feels so fresh about it today. I mean, if we're going to equate movies to food, I think talking about the Marvel Empire, that for me is very much like the fast food culture of cinema as it is today. And, you know, they give you this kind of sugar rush and then afterwards you're kind of left with not a lot. And yeah, this for me is it is that experience or that feeling of going and sitting down and having, even if it's quite a simple meal, having having a dish that you really kind of savour and take time over.
Oh, right. Well, if people want to let us know what they think, then that would be fascinating. Anyway, right, interesting. What's your favourite film about food, David? Do you have one?
Yeah.
What's that?
Called Big Night.
Oh, right, the Stanley Tucci...
Yeah. I think that's an amazing film. It's two Italian brothers, and they run a restaurant, and a critic is going to come and lift them from the doldrums, so they basically... channel all their energies into this big feast, and well, I won't spoil what happens in the end. But there's
do they get their just desserts?
Well, we find out for yourself on
right.
that. But
Adam,
yeah, I'll second that and throw in Delicatessen as
oh,
well.
Oh yeah, right, okay. No love for Ratatouille then.
Do you know what, Ratatouille is possibly my least favourite Pixar film. I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
This is a whole separate episode right here, but. Yeah, I think it's sort of Finding Nemo.
I find that surprising to hear.
I'm
Team Ratatouille big time.
yeah. And my least favourite Pixar film is Finding Nemo 2, unless it's one of the Cars films. It might be one of the Cars films.
I think, I'm just talking kind of original Pixar movies, not okay. sequels.
Well, right. We've got Cars 3 coming up
yeah.
soon.
Did
so...
you read that extraordinary thing in which one of the brains behind the Cars Empire was explaining that in his mind that world exists because the humans basically have all been dispensed with because automated cars have become self-aware?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, you know. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's my vision of humanity in the future. So, I mean, it all adds up.
Yeah. And I'd actually watch that first film again in that context because I reckon there could be a much darker film experience there.
I think you should watch all Pixar films in that context.
Yeah.
Like, Finding Nemo is... it's all Mad Max. It's all
right.
Anyway.
Now, after this bit of drumming, we're going to move on to our next delight. It's our Little White Lies Film Club. This week, about 2046...
Thank you. Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Yep, the Little White Lies Film Club, in which we recommend a film that you may have missed or a classic that's well worth reappraising that generally relates in some way to some film we're discussing. And last week we suggested 2046, One Car Why, set in 1960s Hong Kong. James Gunn, who directed Guardians of the Galaxy 2, said that it was one of the three films that influenced him in the making of that picture. Gentleman Baker says, this 2046 is one of my favourite films of all time, along with its companion piece, the earlier In the Mood for Love. Such beautiful melancholia, it makes my heart heavy to recall it. What would you like to add to that, Mr. Jenkins?
No, it's the same. It's I've rewatched it recently, having not seen it. I think I saw it when it originally came out in the cinemas in 2004, I think it was. And remember feeling a bit weirded out about it, especially because I was absolutely head over heels about In the Mood for Love, which is I think a simpler film in many ways. I guess this is what you would describe as the film of a free man,
right?
As in, he's like, someone signed a check somewhere, you know, pressed it across a table to him and said, "Do whatever you like."
Right.
Because and it kind of feels like that's what it is. In a sort of glorious way and in an infuriating way, but in an always interesting way.
Right. The earlier film, the simpler film, In the Mood for Love, stars Tony Leung, who's back in this one, and Maggie Cheung, as a newspaper man and his beautiful neighbour, who are drawn together when they discover that their respective spouses are actually having an affair with one another. This is a lot less narrative and a lot more kind of lyrical.
I think so, yeah. And it's... It's maybe not the first film I would recommend people if they haven't seen an Ong Kar-wai film before.
Okay.
But it's interesting that it's bookended by In the Mood for Love and then My Blueberry Nights, which is his first English language film, which sort of was critically...
My Blueberry Nights.
Yeah, which is sort of Jude Law.
Nora Jones as
well. Nora Jones, not his best film.
Uh-huh.
But you can definitely see the kind of progression from one to the next. Chungking Express is one of his early films. I think it was possibly the first foreign film I ever saw. Just because I remember seeing it in my local video store, renting it on VHS, just being like dazzled by the VHS artwork. And I probably watched that film 10 or 12 times. And so I've you know, always had an affinity for his films. And I'd say maybe start off with that and In the Mood for Love more so than this. But yeah, there is something really kind of magical and definitely melancholic. It does lull you into this beautiful world that he creates, I think.
It's one of the most ravishing films I can remember seeing. And whilst a little bit frustrating, the lack, if you like, of a narrative arc per se, means that it's really, you know, it is so much about the visuals and sensations, moods, emotions, as opposed to specifically events that I think you can go back and visit even bits of it again and again. A couple of things about, you were saying about the blank check. I really respect the way that he completely committed to his artistic vision. Three cinematographers he used for this. It's like a band having two drummers. I always found that really impressive. So he had three cinematographers. And apparently, I was reading that while he was actually filming it, a photographer managed to get pictures, on-set pictures, and they were published in some Hong Kong magazine. And Wong Kar-wai basically destroyed the set and refilmed it all again so that no one would know what he was making until... You know, he got to put it out there. But just drop-dead gorgeous film. Why do you think James Gunn cited this as an influence for Guardians of the Galaxy 2?
Well, I think... I certainly was trying to think about that. And I think the main link I can discern is that both have these very sort of florid visual sense to them. They both do a lot of interesting things with light and colour and how sort of light and colour move in the frame, I guess. I'm not sure I instantly see the connection. I mean, like, 2046 is this very abstract movie, which is kind of, instead of going along, it kind of almost goes down. It's just layers. It's you know, you're inside someone's mind, then you're inside their fiction, and then you never really know what is reality, what's fantasy, who is a figment of the imagination, who is a fictional construct, and it kind of mingles all these things together at the same time and just sort of lets it fly. And I guess, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is opposite. I mean, you're just very, it's very, you know where you are and you know what planet you're on and you know who you're with. And
the other difference is Guardians of the Galaxy 2, a lot of that is all about how much you can put on screen. Whereas this is how much you leave off screen. I mean, so much of this film is all about large areas of the screen being just left black to frame up on one particular detail. Mm.
And like you say, it's all about the mood and being in the moment and capturing people's reactions as well. He's a master at doing that, I think, in this film.
Yeah. Doesn't look like it was directed by the Hello Kitty creative team, this one.
No. But there's the amazing bit that I sort of rewound and watched a few times where he's having an affair with a woman and it's kind of, they've ended it and they keep seeing each other in the same restaurant over again. And he kind of films that, where he kind of films his reaction, then he cuts to her reaction, he cuts back to his, and you get this kind of little ping pong match of reactions as they're kind of walking past each other. One of the things he's always been interested in is these facial tics and stares and, you know, how people look at each other. And I guess it's that kind of trying to transcend verbal communication.
Right.
You know, it's all about, his films are all about body language. And this, I think, is maybe the kind of ultimate expression of that.
Mm. Some nice food in this one as well.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right. What are we going to do next week on The Film Club?
So next week, in anticipation of Alien Covenant coming out,
wow,
we're going to revisit David Fincher's third film in the original Alien trilogy, which is Alien 3. Or Alien Cubed, as it's styled, which is, I think, the strangest film in the Alien series. A film I've probably only seen once, set on a prison with a sort of cast of British actors and Sigourney Weaver. And it's a film that David Fincher himself disowned,
right,
following some sort of complications with the studio. And yeah, I think it's probably worth a reappraisal.
It's got a troubled history, but it forms part of a great cinematic legacy. It's going to be interesting to see what our reactions are now to it. Have you seen it? I haven't seen it, actually, David. It's the only film from the series I haven't seen.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. I love David Fincher with all my heart. And that's probably the one film... Actually, no, there's two films of his that I'm not a fan of. And one of them's Fight Club, which maybe is another story for another day. And the other one is Alien 3. Sorry to drop that bomb.
I thought Fight Club was an absolute good in that there was no... There's no arguing with it.
We can't talk about that now.
Okay, Fight Club, Why It's No Good by David Jenkins on a future Truth and Movies. Anyway, we'll have our reaction next week to Alien Cubed because, you know, it's exponentially more alien.
I think one of the things we may have to discuss, actually, is I think there's different versions of this film. So I think let's definitely key up which version we should watch.
Okay. Maybe, well, you'll put that out on Twitter, will you?
Maybe we should, like, check with the Twitter folk.
Right.
Which is the premium.
If you want to get in touch with us with your thoughts, at LWLies is the Twitter address. And, Adam, that email address?
Truthandmovies, or one word, at tcolondon.com.
Bingo. A little bit more drumming. Now, to finish off today, we salute Jonathan Demme. And I must admit, I never knew that's how you pronounced his name, but Jonathan Demme, who passed away end of last week. Is that right, David?
Yeah, I think just after we'd released this podcast.
Right, age of 73 and a massively influential director in the 80s and 90s when you think of films like, well, Silence of the Lambs. Jack Levani actually tweeting and saying, to what extent did Silence of the Lambs influence tonally and stylistically the 90s? X-Files and Seven spring to mind as examples of this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson have cited him as an influence. And I think he's possibly the most underappreciated director of his generation.
Why do you think that is?
Just in what he... Not necessarily in the films that he made. I don't think you would look at his filmography and say he is kind of one of the all-time great American directors, but certainly from a kind of technical and formal point of view, I think he definitely pushed the boundaries in terms of his use of close-up and framing, just to kind of drive the narrative, but also lock you in on a specific character.
Right. Really diverse body of work from kind of the early things like Melvin and Howard, Stop Making Sense, Something Wild.
Which, I love Something Wild.
Right, part of that whole yuppie nightmare genre, which was so big in the...
That needs to return.
The yuppie nightmare.
Yeah, the After Hours. And
After
the,
Hours. Yeah. And Into the Night, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But then you had mentioned Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, which was huge, the Manchurian Candidate remake, and Rachel Getting Married, which I don't know if you were going to nominate John, for anyone who's not familiar with Demme's oeuvre, If you suggest a couple of films to see, I would certainly say Stop Making Sense and Rachel Getting Married, which I loved.
Those two are both brilliant, and yeah, along with maybe like Something Wild and some of his like really early Roger Corman ones. And in fact, one of my, one of my favourite of his films is actually his sort of swan song, which is a film called Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, which is...
What happens in that one?
It's a concert film involving Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids. And in fact, it was actually something that... It played at like a film festival, the Toronto Film Festival. Mm. And it was just one of these things that if I was at the festival, I probably wouldn't have gone to see it. And if I hadn't read about it, I probably wouldn't have just chanced upon it. But it just had this amazing critical reaction. All these critics were seeing it and going, you know, this is the best film at the festival. It's
really
a Justin Timberlake concert film. The way he films it is just astonishing. I mean, it's similar to Stop Making Sense in that he uses these quite wide-angle shots. So he includes the whole band. You can see people working together. You can see how Timberlake himself is the central figure, but he's enhanced by all this other stuff that's going on. And I think one of the things that you hear often about Demme is he's... He's like a real humanist, and I think that translates in through his films as well. I mean, he loves people, and he loves celebrating what people do and, you know, how they express themselves. But reading some of the really incredible stuff that has been written about him posthumously, he just comes like nobody has a bad word to say about him. I mean, he was apparently, you know, he's not like this kind of cigar chomping nightmare who would like kick chairs over on a set. I mean, he was just a lovely guy who would, you know, want to make the experience of making a movie a positive one, happy experience. Like, let's make this a fun thing, not a nightmare. You know, so it comes through in his films in that kind of love of people, I think.
Right. Adam, have you got a favourite or a couple of favourites?
Rachel Getting Married is one that really resonated with me when I first saw it. And actually, it feels like it's a bit of a throwback to some of his early 70s and 80s films. So definitely a good one to watch if you've not seen any of his films before. I mean, I guess most people are familiar with Silence of the Lambs, but actually I'd recommend people go and revisit that as well.
Really?
Yeah, I think there's a lot in there which... I don't know, you might not appreciate kind of just how good it is.
Really?
Kind of
I probably don't, because I remember at the time not liking it very much. That film, for me, suffered hugely from the fact that the Manhunter, which had come out before, I thought did a better job. It didn't have Brian Cox as Hannibal Lecter, who'd been brilliant in the role. I mean, just scary good, I think, a year or two earlier. And it said it had Anthony Hopkins of being all kind of lovey and stuff and chewing on as much scenery as he did kind of, you know, anyone's liver with fava beans, to be fair. But, when I get a moment, I'll go back and watch that again. Certainly a much missed figure than Jonathan Demme and Justin Timberlake. What an extraordinary choice. Yeah.
It's just a different counterpoint, I guess, to something like Rachel Getting Married, which is a sort of fairly low-key, melancholy drama, and you've got this amazing immersive concert film. And he made...
Have you seen it too, Adam?
I've seen it as well. I think it's on Netflix, possibly.
Ooh, okay. And he made some amazing... all his concert films were great. He did some really good ones with Neil Young. He's done three with Neil Young, which were all really good.
Talking Heads and Bruce Springsteen, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Well, he was a music video with the UB40 and Chrissy Hynde, I Got You, Babe.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Who are the Tennessee Boys? If that's not a spoiler.
The Tennessee Kids.
The Tennessee Kids.
Oh, that's just his band. That's his backup
band.
It's not just a guy playing an iPod. It's like he has an actual full band playing all the songs.
Right. It'd be great if he'd started out walking out with just an iPod, which he put down on the centre of the stage and then... No, okay. And then start singing Sexy Back, which is literally the only Justin Timberlake song.
You get a real sense of the scale of this production as well, because you've got obviously Justin and the Tennessee Kids, the backing band. You've also got all these dancers and, I guess, behind the scenes, stagehands and production people and lighting, and everyone is part of this huge unit that puts together this amazing show, basically, that you're sort of privy
to. Well, I have to see this now. I have to see this.
I just hope that... It wasn't all done for the cameras. You know, the cameras are rolling, let's pretend we're a big family.
Don't you think that Demme would have been wise to that?
Yeah, no, I think he would. That's just my cynicism coming through there. Anyway, that's probably a good note to end on.
Yeah. But anyway, one of the good guys, Jonathan Demme.
Absolutely.
Mm. All right, well, next week, then, we'll be back with, Alien Covenant. And your thoughts, hopefully, do get in touch. To play us out, there's a little nod to... one of the greatest concert movies of all time. No, don't worry, it's the Stop Making Sense one. Here is Talking Heads on Once in a Lifetime. This has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.